got a sprain or an itch. Pain that's swelling or twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. The following statement is paraphrased from Pain News Weekly. Deaths from opioid overdose have skyrocketed in the past 18 years. While the crisis started with opioid prescriptions, illegal opioids have been fueling the crisis for nearly a decade. The general consensus assigns blame primarily on physicians with predictable results. Now, no one disputes that there is an opioid crisis in this country. As the CDC stated, nearly 48,000 Americans have died after overdosing on any opioids in 2017. And the rate at which people are dying from opioid overdose increased fivefold between 1999 and 2017. The problem we now have is to end the so-called epidemic. Before we start on the discussion concerning this, I think that we really need to begin with the definition of an epidemic, as it may confuse or even inflame certain people. So I'd like to first define the word epidemic that is frequently used when speaking about the rise in mortality and morbidity as concerned with opioids.
Generally, the word epidemic means something affecting an unusually large number of individuals at the same time. An example of this might be the outbreak of typhoid.
The term epidemic may also mean something excessively prevalent, as in the use of epidemic in the phrase epidemic laughter. Epidemic can also be characterized as a very widespread growth or extent of relating to or even constituting an epidemic. The sentence, "the practice has reached epidemic proportions," is a good example of this use of the word epidemic. But because of its use, often in an inflammatory manner, I'll try to use other terms less inflammatory in the rest of the show.
In order to help alleviate the problems associated with an increase in overall misuse of opioids, we need first to find the cause and then find the solution to lessen the problem of opioid misuse.
Just so that you know where we're going with all of this, I'd like to tell you that I feel that several, if not the majority, of attempts to do just that are well-intentioned efforts, but have in reality simply made things worse. I remember an old saying that states, "The operation was a success. Unfortunately, the patient died." I'm presently looking at a graph that was created by the CDC or Center for Disease Control. Now, you can find this on the internet at https://wonder.cdc.gov. The title of the graph is Overdose Death Rates Involving Opioids by Type, United States from the year 2000 to 2017.
There are four lines in the graph. The first line represents the change over the years in total deaths per 100,000 population of any opioid. Another line represents heroin, while a third line shows the rise of commonly prescribed opioids. The fourth and final line represents the increase in deaths due to other synthetic opioids, such as fentanyl and tramadol.
That's a 17-year span. Heroin was pretty steady as far as deaths per 100,000 population until around the year 2010, when it seems that it increased steadily till around 2016, when it plateaued at about four times what it had been, since the death rate in 1999 was just around 0.8 per 100,000 population, to end around 5 deaths per 100,000 population. On the other hand, deaths related to the commonly prescribed opioids, these being natural and semi-synthetic opioids, and these included methadone, and started around 1.4 deaths per 100,000 and rose slowly to around 4 deaths in 2010, where it has fluctuated from 3.8 to 4.8 until the year 2017, when this graph ends.
Now we are going to look at the other synthetic opioids. This also started low as far as mortality, since the death rate in 1999 was around 0.4 to 1 death per 100,000. For the period 1999 to 2013, so for 14 years and remained pretty steady. Again, that is until 2013, when in the space of just 4 years, it rose to where it is now at around 8 deaths per 100,000 U.S. population.
It is no wonder now that the graph of total opioid deaths has risen. That it is mainly due to the fact that total opioid deaths is, as its title indicates, the total deaths caused by all opioids, including those due to fentanyl. But before you start blaming fentanyl, let's look at this more carefully, because that number includes not only those people who are prescribed fentanyl, but also those who illegally and illicitly used fentanyl, which caused their death.
In 1986, a 31-year-old cancer specialist began arguing that millions of non-cancer patients were suffering unnecessarily, not really an untrue statement, because at that point in time, strong pain relievers were not part of the treatment plan of most physicians who treated pain at any time, especially patients with chronic pain.
For the sake of the show, we are not going to name the physician, as you can find this easily on the internet if you're interested. However, this physician stated that doctors could use opioids to treat non-cancer pain patients safely and effectively. Many physicians were convinced of this through journal articles and advertising campaigns of various pharmaceutical companies.
We are not here to judge these companies' motives. Many may have felt that they were doing a service to the millions of Americans who were suffering from chronic pain. After all, there was a limited number of medications that helped those in chronic pain anyway.
As more and more of these prescriptions were written, mostly by physicians who really felt that they were helping these patients, and they probably were and still are, then problems seemed to lie, and the actual facts seemed to bear this out, that the number of overdose deaths were not the patients themselves who were overdosing, but that most of those who died taking these pills were not those prescribed the medications, but people who obtained the drugs by other means, such as through theft or diversion. And we'll get to that in a moment.
On the street, the pills were routinely crushed and then inhaled or injected to produce the high users were looking for.
Drug addicts are not often looking for pain relief. Rather, they look towards the opioids for another effect they can have, and that is euphoria, which could be defined as a feeling of great happiness and excitement.
Furthermore, it is not the concentration of the drug in the brain, but the rate of increase of the drug into the brain that causes this euphoria.
What made the new delayed-release formulations so appealing was how much more of the active ingredient each pill contained.
While the immediate-release formulation, such as oxycodone, contained 2.5 milligrams to 30 milligrams of the drug, each delayed-release pill could have as much as 80 milligrams.
So by crushing an extended-release pill and inhaling or injecting it, you could get a whopping dose of the drug into the brain very quickly. And after 10 years of increased use of the extended-release forms of the opioids, one of the larger producers of these drugs replaced their drug with an abuse deterrent formulation. In other words, their extended release drug was made way more difficult to use by inhaling or injecting. This is because the new form, the extended release pill, could no longer be crushed to access the opioid that it contained.
You can understand what happened then. Just as in any business, when the product became less useful, the street value of the drug plummeted almost immediately, as did the number of overdose deaths from prescribed opioids.
But in your mind's eye, look at that graph again. The new formulation did nothing to slow the overall rise in opioid-related deaths.
In fact, the number of such deaths began to surge dramatically following the release of the new abuse deterrent formulation.
Huh? What happened?
A 2019 study in the Review of Economic and Statistics explain this quandary. Now that the extended-release medications that could be easily used by drug addicts had decreased and were no longer appealing to opioid abusers, many addicts simply shifted to heroin.
Anyway, heroin was actually, in most cases, cheaper and readily available on the street. It was also unregulated, so users never knew how much of the drug that they were injecting into their veins or what it might be laced with. That's a key here, which we'll get to in just a moment. So from around 2010 until 2016, heroin use and overdose deaths climbed rapidly.
But this increase in use of heroin actually caused another problem on the street. By 2013, the demand for heroin was outstripping the supply.
You know, drug dealers don't like losing money or anything that cuts into their profits, so they had to come up with something that would bolster the sale of their products. And now we get to fentanyl. Remember I promised that we'd get to that?
To make up the shortfall, and keep fueling the illegal market, suppliers turn primarily to fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is cheaper to produce than heroin and 30 to 40 times more powerful.
Another characteristic that the dealers liked is that, unlike heroin, fentanyl is produced entirely in the lab, so production can be ramped up whenever suppliers want, regardless of the season or global weather changes.
By 2016, illegal fentanyl surpassed heroin as the leading cause of opioid-related overdose deaths.
Unfortunately, you, like most Americans, may never have heard much from the media about this.
So despite the overwhelming evidence that fentanyl and other illegal synthetic opioids are now driving the crisis, recent efforts to combat overdose deaths have continued to focus on prescription drugs.
Remember that fentanyl is also a prescription drug when used by someone who is prescribed the medication. It is a potent pain reliever. So what happened then in our timeline? The CDC in 2016 published their guideline for physicians in how to correctly prescribe opioids for chronic pain. Of course, it never really addressed the main problem, that being the illegal use of these same drugs that are used by millions of Americans to control their chronic pain.
Again, the primary recommendations concern dosage and duration of use of the opioids by patients and not how to prevent or stop the illegal use of these same drugs that were, in fact, causing the high mortality and morbidity in the USA.
It's not that the guide was incorrect in its recommendations, and I want you to put that word in bold letters. That is, recommendations. The guideline was, in the words of the CDC, a guideline to physicians. Doctors were told they should carefully reassess evidence of individual benefits and risks when considering increasing dosage a certain number and should avoid increasing dosage to a higher specified daily dose. The guideline also recommended that physicians carefully justify a decision to increase that dosage above that recommended ceiling.
As numerous experts, including the American Medical Association, stated, these CDC recommendations enumerated in the guideline were widely misinterpreted.
The wording in the guideline really made it clear that the recommendations would apply only to patients who are being started on opioids, not those who have been using them safely under a doctor's care, often for years. Unfortunately, and this is where the problem begins, the guidelines are now being used by legislators, pharmacy chains, and insurers to restrict prescriptions for all patients on opioids for any reason.
The truth is that opioid prescribing has declined a lot between 2014 and 2017. And that is not just us saying it. This is according to a recent article in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
So, in a bold but true statement, we can safely say that since prescribed opioids are no longer driving the opioid crisis, and haven't been for nearly a decade, this reduction in opioid prescribing has done nothing to slow the rise in overdose deaths. If anything, deaths from fentanyl and other synthetics have increased dramatically since the CDC guidelines were published.
We can now safely say that what is happening is that the opposite of solving the opioid crisis has occurred as we continue to limit prescribing by doctors.
It's not only causing irreparable harm to those who have been receiving appropriate medical care for their chronic pain and to the physicians who treat them, but to those that are illicitly using these drugs. Just for one moment, let me stop for that moment and talk about the war on poverty. You remember that? You may not be old enough to remember when it started, but the war on poverty is the unofficial name for legislation first introduced by United States President Lyndon B. Johnson during a State of the Union address on Wednesday, January 8, 1964. In that year, at the end of his term of office of 1969, the poverty level was around 12.4% of the U.S. population. So, since the war on poverty has been, well, fought now, we now have a poverty level, at least in 2017, of 12.3. Not much of a success in that war. I mention this because we are now calling this an epidemic and in need of a war on drugs. I hope that this does not end up with the same kind of results as we got with the war on poverty.
After more than 18 years and 700,000 deaths, the U.S. has still not figured out how to stop the opioid crisis. In some cases, efforts meant to help have only made things worse.
The Center for Disease Control's prescribing guidelines are a tragic case in point.
Now, as recently as April of this year, the FDA or Federal Drug Administration suggested the extent of the damage caused by the CDC's guideline.
And on April 9th, the FDA reported that pain patients denied the opioid treatment were suffering serious withdrawal symptoms, uncontrolled pain, psychological distress, and suicide. Less than a week later, the CDC published a clarification in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Unfortunately for many, the correction came too late. For most, the harmful effects of the guidelines linger in laws and policies still on the books.
I'll say son, I knock, but there's nothing there. This is not just idle chatter. According to the New York Times, more than 300 medical experts, including three former White House drug czars, signed a letter to the CDC in March, contending that the guidelines were harming pain patients who had been taking high doses of opioids for years without becoming addicted. It's not the CDC guidelines per se that are hurting these patients.
It is again important to remember that it is not the guideline itself that is to blame. As we said, the guideline consists of a series of recommendations to those that treat pain.
Again, a guideline. But it is the way insurance companies and states have translated them into rigid laws and policies. As for profit organizations, private insurance companies win whenever their costs are lowered. Decrease the amount of medications that they have to pay for, and you increase their profits.
The government benefits, as well since programs such as Medicaid and Medicare also have less expense when less medications are covered.
Have you ever been driving in a car when a policeman in his vehicle pulls up behind you? And no matter what speed you go, the police car remains behind you. It can often be unnerving. In fact, many, in just such a situation, are pushed to drive, let's say, erratically until the police car pulls them over. It's not that you've been doing anything illegal, nor has the policeman, but somehow the situation itself promotes the traffic stop.
It is what many physicians felt. So in response to the pressures, many physicians simply dropped pain patients or stopped prescribing opioids altogether.
According to a study in the American Journal of Public Health, in some cases, the change in policy was adopted literally overnight. Many patients seeking refills were simply told that they needed to stop taking opioids.
In response to this problem, on October 10, 2019, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, published a new guideline for clinicians on the appropriate dosage reduction or discontinuation of long-term opioid analgesics.
This guide, again, this is a guide, not a regulation or law. This guide provides advice to clinicians who are considering or actually starting to lower the doses prescribed to their patients who have been on long-term opioid therapy for chronic pain. And just like the CDC guideline stated, in each case, the physician should review the risks and benefits of the current therapy with the patient. And I want to underline that, with the patient, and decide if tapering is appropriate based on individual circumstances. And just like the CDC guideline, most of the recommendation, not all, were common sense recommendations that physicians have been or should have been following in their daily practices regardless of their specialties.
For example, there is a recommendation that states that weighing the risk to benefit of the treatment should be considered.
Well, that's a Captain Obvious statement. How about considering the Hippocratic Oath? You've probably heard of that. One item in that oath states, primum non nocere, meaning first do no harm. It's an oath that the physician recites or used to recite, stating that he or she will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm. There's even another equivalent phrase found in Epidemics, Book 1 of the Hippocratic School, that says, practice two things in your dealings with disease, either help or do not harm the patient.
So, with that in mind, when should the doctor consider reducing or discontinuing opioid therapy? Well, first of all, when the benefit to harm balance is no longer clear,
or the patient's pain and function are not meaningfully improved by a higher dose. What else would be a valid reason to lower the dosage? Well, how about if the patient experiences side effects that diminish their quality of life or impair function?
An increased risk of overdose, such as when a patient shows evidence of opioid misuse or even exhibits warning signs such as confusion, sedation, or slurred speech.
Another reason to stop or decrease the dose of opioids is if the patient is receiving medications such as the benzodiazepines in addition to the medications for pain, or have an increased risk for adverse outcomes. So now, let us assume that there's a reason to taper the dose. What's a doctor to do? Always explain to the patient why you want or need to lower the dosage that the patient is receiving. Again, that seems to be a no-brainer.
The physician needs to make decisions based on individual patient's needs. The doctor always should consider whether opioids continue to meet treatment goals.
At risk of repeating myself, and I often do here, the physician should share decision-making with the patients. Tapering is more likely to be successful when the patients are included in the decisions, such as when medication will be decreased first and how quickly tapering will occur. It's always advantageous to all parties involved that the physician discuss with the patient what he or she might experience during the period of lowering the dose.
In the meantime, physicians intimidated by the current crackdown on opioid prescribing are more likely than ever to cut off patients who seek continued opioid treatment after their physical pain has ended.
As with chronic pain patients, the result is more suffering and potentially more illegal use of opioids, as those in mental anguish seek relief wherever they can find it.
And yet, just last year, President Trump announced an initiative to, among other things, cut nationwide opioid prescribing by one-third within 3 years.
We have, I think, amply demonstrated that the continuing single-minded focus on opioid prescribing is simply outdated. We've also shown that prescriptions are no longer the cause of the opioid crisis, and targeting physicians who prescribe high doses of opioids is far more likely to snare responsible pain doctors who are willing and able to manage difficult cases.
For example, the North Carolina Medical Board recently found that 43% of those in survey, or 663 physicians, have stopped opioid prescribing altogether.
And law enforcement continues to use state prescription drug monitoring programs to identify physicians misusing opioids. The government has this idea that if we can simply get everybody to quit prescription opioids, we're going to solve the whole opioid overdose death crisis. I do not believe that this is true, and I hope you agree with us. Raiding doctors' offices without due diligence endangers patients and destroys careers. It also breeds fear among other responsible physicians. The same thing is happening in other states as well, especially in those 33 states that have passed laws restricting prescriptions. The real problem is that the ones most impacted by these efforts are not the illegal drug suppliers, but the patients with intractable pain and undiagnosed mental health problems who are suffering along with the dedicated professionals trying to care for them. Carmen and I also talked about the October 10th, 2019 U.S. Department of Health and Human Services publication of a new guide for clinicians on the appropriate dose reduction or discontinuation of long-term opioid analgesics, which provides advice to clinicians who are contemplating or initiating a reduction in opioid dosage or discontinuation of long-term opioid therapy for chronic pain. In each case, the clinicians should review the risks and benefits of the current therapy with the patient and decide if tapering is appropriate. Next week, we're going to take a brief look at this new guide. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at compassionatecarejacks.com. where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.